I've only been a civil rights advocate. It would have been pretty easy for me to kind of go crawl under a sofa. And believe me, I had thoughts about doing that. But I actually can't imagine sitting on the sidelines at this moment in history.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
I'm Tina Brown, and you're listening to TBD. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable, that every step towards justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle. And right now, for many Americans, it feels as though we're backing away from the goal of justice instead of advancing towards it, which is why we need our warriors fighting for civil rights more than ever. Vanita Gupta hadn't even turned 40 when she was appointed by President Obama in 2014 to run the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. She was the first woman, the first person of South Asian descent, and the youngest to ever hold the job. In that post, she helped put down the flames in Ferguson and Baltimore by investigating police brutality in the deaths of Michael Brown and Freddie Gray, and put in motion reforms in those police departments afterwards. She also battled for transgender rights and against voter suppression. Raised in Philadelphia by immigrant parents from India, Gupta pursued her passion for civil rights by working for the ACLU and NAACP after graduating from NYU Law. Now she heads the mighty coalition of 200 different civil rights groups brought together under the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. It's a powerful platform from which Gupta pushes back every day against Trumpian assault on asylum seekers, LGBTQ citizens, and Americans trying to exercise their right to vote. I first met her last year at Preet Bharara's Cafe Change Summit, where it was obvious that she's a legal rock star. Vanita, welcome to TBD.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, I've always admired you, Vanita, because you seem to be genuinely so galvanized by a passion for justice. And I guess I'd like to ask you, you know, where did this come from? How did it happen that you became such a warrior for justice?
Well, first, let me just say thank you for that. It's hard for me to pinpoint kind of a specific trigger that led me to go down the path to fighting for social justice and being a public interest lawyer. But I think we're all kind of products of our upbringing. And when I was quite young, at around the age of 4, my family had moved to Britain. And it was right around the time that Margaret Thatcher had been elected. And there was a rise of the skinhead movement in Britain. And I remember pretty distinctly kind of going to a McDonald's after we had picked up my grandmother from India at the airport and being at a table with a group of 4 skinhead men throwing French fries at us, yelling at us to go home. Pockies, the derogatory term used against Indians and South Asians in Britain. And for some reason, that memory is really, it's probably one of my earliest memories, but is seared into me. And it caused me to always, at a very young age, even though I was hardly a political young child, be conscious of my status as kind of a brown person in restaurants or in stores. And growing up, I had a sister who came out as lesbian when I was in high school to parents who had had an arranged marriage in India and who could have never foreseen this as part of their future. And all of these different experiences, I think, really shaped who I am and kind of the choices that I made about what I wanted to do with my life and career. And to me, honestly, I can't imagine doing any other kind of work. It's just always been what I have found to be meaningful, what has driven me.
Well, you, in your very first case as a young lawyer, when you were really fresh out of school, your work led a judge to throw out wrongful convictions against 38 people in Tulia, Texas. That's pretty astonishing. Tell me about that case.
That was a case out of West Texas. It was a panhandle town called Tulia, as you said, between Amarillo and Lubbock. And I had just graduated from law school and had a fellowship to go work at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and knew that I wanted to work on disparities, racial disparities in drug sentencing. This was 2001 when our country was binging on mass incarceration. Most states were spending more on building prisons than they were on investing in higher education. We had 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population. And I had flown down. I'd watched an 11-minute documentary about this drug sting that had happened on July 23rd, 1999, in this town. Over 12% of the town's adult male population, black population, had been arrested on the uncorroborated word of an undercover narcotics officer by the name of Tom Coleman, a white man who had had a pretty sordid history in law enforcement. So what happened on July 23rd was the sheriff called local TV stations to stand outside of the jail with cameras. They had a SWAT team in full militarized regalia in this teeny tiny town in Texas, bang through people's doors at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., arrest them, and then haul them, you know, looking the way you and I would look if we had been woken up out of bed at 4 a.m., in front of the TV cameras that had been stationed out. And later that morning, the local newspaper, the Tulia Herald, carried the headline, "Tulia Streets Cleared of Garbage," listed out the names and addresses of every single one of the 46 people who had been arrested, 40 of whom are black. And so I saw this documentary 2 years after this drug sting had taken place.
And at which time they were incarcerated?
They were mostly either all incarcerated or awaiting trial or in the middle of plea negotiations to try to get deals that were going to be less than what some of their predecessors had gotten. And so it was 2 years. I was at a civil rights conference, watched this video, and was really affected by the story because there was something that seemed so incredibly wrong about a town of 5,000, 46 people get arrested for alleged very low level, between 1 and 4 grams of powder cocaine sales to this one undercover narcotics officer. And it's like, if you've got 46 drug dealers in a town, Tina, of 5,000, is everyone on drugs? I mean, the numbers just didn't add up. And so I, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, very inexperienced young lawyer that I was, flew down and just started digging, went to the courthouse, started to pull files, made a chart of who the 46 people were, the men and women that they were, who their lawyers were, what they'd been charged with. It was pretty primitive. I bought a suitcase at the local Walmart to fill with papers and then met with families. There was one family, Maddie White, who's a prison guard locally, because that was the only job she could get. 4 of her children were incarcerated as a result of this sting. Really, you know, astonishing stories. And it turned out the state attorney general then, John Cornyn, who is now a U.S. senator, had given Tom Coleman the Lawman of the Year award after he had done the sting. And as we started to dig, it turned out this whole thing was bogus, and that Tom Coleman had been arrested himself during the 18 months he'd conducted the sting for theft and abuse of official capacity, for using the N-word about these folks. So it's an incredible story that then was written into a book by Nate Blakeslee, who did a fantastic job really talking about what was happening in America at that time in the war on drugs.
How much do you follow an instinct like that when you're looking at these cases? Do you bring that gut feeling to something isn't right here?
Yeah, I do. I'm kind of more of an intuitive lawyer. I am not your strongest brief writer who's going to write the most beautiful appellate brief in front of a computer. What I am is somebody who really kind of gets steeped into the facts. And I think that some of the most powerful ways in which we've engaged in criminal justice reform in the last several years in this country has really been animated by stories. And the stories that one tells that humanize who the men and women are in our jails and prisons.
As you were talking, I was thinking of the prison guard. I could see her. And it immediately became so much more vivid to me.
Right, right. I mean, ultimately, it's like when you peel away the statistics and you actually start to talk about the stories of how these things play out in real people's lives, what happens in the town. And when I first started digging, it really felt like there was an incredible story that needed to be unearthed. And I also recognized that in so many ways, what was happening in Tulia, Texas in 2001 was really a microcosm of what was happening and has been happening in towns all over the country.
Well, you handled some momentous cases at the DOJ, including investigations, of course, into the deaths of Freddie Gray in Baltimore and Michael Brown in Ferguson. Your work led to both those cities actually being put under consent decrees, which means that a federal judge is overseeing the reform of those police departments. To me, that sounds like a very sort of bureaucratic end to all of this. I mean, is it an end? And has anything changed in those cities?
By the time the Justice Department actually would make a decision to do that kind of very intensive intervention, it was usually because the city was at a crisis point. In Baltimore, in Ferguson, in Cleveland, in Albuquerque, in places around the country, these consent decrees are very much a work in progress. They're at differing stages. But if you look at kind of at what happened to the LAPD over time, what you look at what happened to the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, you look at Seattle, these are examples of how with intensive work and focus with political will, it takes money as well. Police departments and communities can really have a pretty radical transformation of their relationship.
I would also think there must be tremendous resentment. If you're the police department, you've had, in a sense, the Justice Department sicked onto you to figure out what's going on. I would imagine that that creates a tremendous sort of distrust amongst the people concerned and people who are collaborating and people who aren't, and a whole kind of feeling of distrust. I mean, how does it work?
You're right. It's somewhat intrusive, and I think we all have to acknowledge that it is. With police officers, there's a very difficult relationship with the Justice Department. But oftentimes, I mean, I met more with law enforcement and communities around policing issues during my just under two and a half years at the Justice Department. It was the top priority. And it was really important for me to put myself in the rooms with police unions that, you know, had generally been pretty hostile to the Justice Department's interventions, and to explain what we were doing. And oftentimes these consent decrees actually, while really focusing on the massive civil rights violations that are happening, are also finding ways to better support police officers through training, through more consistent accountability measures and systems, supervision, giving much more guidance around use of force and de-escalation. And our experts are members of law enforcement.
So when you walked into those rooms full of these hostile cops, I mean, what was that like? What did they say to you?
So to me, so much of being able to get done what we need to get done is about relationships and building trust, but also not being naive about where we disagree and carrying kind of the mantle of righteousness as you go, but with humility. And so I talked a lot throughout my tenure to the Fraternal Order of Police. I brought them in before we made announcements about, you know, launching investigations. And I many times was walking in as a small brown-skinned lady and in a room of 200 mostly white, almost exclusively male officers, and going up and standing on the stage and taking their questions. And I think in some ways, even my kind of physical appearance is a little bit disarming to folks in a way. But I think just showing up and not being kind of afraid to be in their space and having a very honest, candid, mutually respectful conversation about the kind of issues of the day was important.
What was the sort of most common exchange that you had with these people? And what did they want from you?
They wanted, the officers in particular, really wanted me to understand how challenging their job is and how misunderstood they felt they were at the time kind of nationally. They felt like there was so much more kind of press on the violations and, you know, there's a little bit of the kind of bad actor scenario.
Right.
It was really stark to me. I would start my day sometimes when I'd go to a city meeting with police officers and police chiefs, and then meeting in the afternoon with mothers who had lost their sons to police violence. And the language of the morning versus the afternoon was completely stark and different. But the pain was
Tell me what
real.
You mean by that.
The afternoon was full of pain and really women talking about what their sons, what they were experiencing every day in terms of the harassment, the degradation. There has been gross disinvestment in a lot of these cities for the kinds of supports that families need, and that law enforcement has kind of become the go-to. And that's where there was common ground, actually.
Certainly true about mental illness.
Yes, and drug abuse.
And drug abuse,
substance use disorders. I think now there is greater recognition even among law enforcement that they have become, you know, the kind of singular response in a really unfair way in low-income communities of color that has resulted in the over-criminalization. But I'm not naive. I mean, look, there's a ton of tension and so much work to be done.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
What distresses me right now is just the direction of the Justice Department.
Let's get to that, because you now have a powerful platform as head of the nation's, you know, very premier civil rights organization. And I can only ask you, what is it like doing your job in this era of Trump? I mean, it must have been shell-shocking in a sense for you to move into this role just as Trump took over, really.
Yeah, it was. I was leaving an administration where both of the attorneys general that I had served and the president were really leaning forward on civil rights and criminal justice reform. Again, there were still tons of headwinds, but to go from that to then what we ended up and where we've ended up with Jeff Sessions as attorney general, obviously now no longer, and Trump as president. I've only been a civil rights advocate. It would have been pretty easy for me to kind of go crawl under a sofa. And believe me, I had thoughts about doing that. But I actually can't imagine sitting on the sidelines at this moment in history. I think I would actually be quite thoroughly depressed if I was doing that. It has been really hard, I think, for so many of us who care so deeply about inclusion and diversity and the most vulnerable among us. But it's been a lot harder for the communities that have been facing kind of the butt of this in terms of, you know, newly arrived immigrants, people who are living in fear every day about, like, dreamers about what's going to happen and whether the only country they've ever known they're going to be permitted to stay in.
Well, not since Richard Nixon have we had a president who so blatantly tries to get the Justice Department to do his bidding. I don't want to just play this clip of Trump at a campaign rally in August.
Our Justice Department and our FBI have to start doing their job and doing it right and doing it now. Because people are angry. People are angry. What's happening is a disgrace. And at some point, I wanted to stay out. But at some point, if it doesn't straighten out properly, I want them to do their job. I will get involved and I'll get in there if I have to.
Well, so as a former senior DOJ official, what goes through your mind when you hear the president say, I'll get in there if I have to?
You know, this president has had no regard for the kinds of the reason why we have lines between the Justice Department and the White House, the importance of keeping the Justice Department and law enforcement as depoliticized as possible. His constant critique and tirade against the Justice Department and the FBI, I think, is incredibly corrosive. we can undo a lot of the policy decisions that Trump and the administration have made. But what is so destructive and will be much more damaging over the long term are the attacks on some of our core democratic institutions. You know, he has attacked the free press. He attacks the federal judiciary. He attacks federal law enforcement and the Justice Department. He attacks the intelligence community. And these are the kinds of things that I think are going to be much harder for us to dig out of. I believe that, you know, the United States has strong democratic institutions, but there is really an overt effort to kind of degrade some of those core institutions. And that is why when government isn't going to protect these institutions, it's up to all of us on the outside to do what we can to shore them up and to also make sure that the American public and our young people feel kind of connected in that fight so that they don't give up or they don't kind of get so cynical that they stop participating. And that's why I think, you know, in some ways the midterm elections were so important. This was a time where people needed to come out in great numbers to show that they cared about this country. And they did. And you saw, you know, some of the highest turnout. We now have the most diverse Congress in our nation's history.
And you recently testified in front of that.
I did. I was just in January, in late January, testified at the first hearing that the House of Representatives had on their big monster democracy reform bill called H.R. 1. And it was so amazing to see in the front row all of the new freshmen members of Congress, the most diverse. There are now the first two Muslim American women.
It must have been very thrilling to see that.
It was thrilling. It has been thrilling.
What did you feel when you watched the Kavanaugh hearings, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings?
We were very involved in opposing Brett Kavanaugh, in making sure that there was a fair process and there wasn't. It was an extraordinary violation of typical confirmation process that the American public only had access to 10% of his record throughout the hearings. There had been active kind of suppression of his background.
What do you think was the biggest miss in his background that the American public didn't
know? I mean, there's a huge black hole around what he said and was involved with when he was in the White House. You know, there were a lot of major policy decisions that were made when he was in the White House. And I will say, though, We were very involved even after Dr. Blasey Ford's the details of her story came out. And I was in the Senate Judiciary hearing room when Dr. Blasey Ford testified in the morning, and then Brett Kavanaugh engaged in his kind of rageful screed in the afternoon. And it was really painful. I'm never, ever going to forget that day. In the morning, there was this woman who was clearly kind of overwhelmed by needing to testify in the Senate. A panel of all white men to her left of Republicans. Not a single Republican woman had ever served on the Senate Judiciary Committee until this Congress in its history.
That's so stunning, isn't it?
It is stunning.
Just right there. Stunning.
That is not appropriate for 2018 as it was then. But she was answering all of the questions as best she could. She acknowledged the details she couldn't recall. Not a single senator on either side tried to impeach her credibility. Remember, this was the spectacle of where the Republican male senators were kind of couldn't trust themselves to actually ask her questions directly in a respectful way. So they got this prosecutor from Arizona to do. I mean, it was such a scene. But she was extraordinary. And her testimony was unimpeachable. She was specific and credible. And then we were met with Brett Kavanaugh, who came in that afternoon rageful, partisan, you know, accusing the Democrats, this post-Clinton conspiracy stuff, completely unbecoming and unfit for a future Supreme Court justice. And it was astonishing. And the days that followed with what I think was a sham FBI investigation, I think that there needs to be investigations into what limits were placed by the White House on the FBI's ability to thoroughly investigate that matter. Dr. Blasey Ford was never approached by the FBI in that week that they were supposed to be conducting the investigation. She had given them a list of many witnesses who would have spoken to the FBI that the FBI never talked to, presumably because they had been told by the White House not to. You know, and so we are where we are. The court is forever changed. We got a lot closer than we ever imagined on the vote. It was one vote away. It was a really, really painful process. And Brett Kavanaugh, really, I think we don't – there was a lot that was hidden in this confirmation process, but there was a lot that was also revealed about him, about the Republicans who stood by. But we are where we are now. And for the leadership conference, the importance of a fair and independent judiciary, which has really been a backstop for the Trump administration in so many ways, is a really important fight to wage.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Well, a lot of people were very happy to see the back of Jeff Sessions, who, to my mind, was a kind of malevolent little fruit bat.
I just can't ever get the SNL skit out of my head. I mean, she's like forever implanted in my head.
Forever implanted. You have to say about Sessions is, though, I mean, even though Trump himself, you know, totally ridiculed him all the time, he was actually pretty effective
in his
awful way.
I think that history will say that despite the fact that Jeff Sessions was kind of the butt of jokes by the president and then, you know, many others, he probably is one of the most effective cabinet secretaries that the president had. And he knew where the levers of power were. He had been in the Justice Department before. And frankly, the reality is I think that we gave him a roadmap. He pretty systematically, you know, withdrew the memo guidances that we had issued. He tried to get out of consent decrees that we were in. I think we gave him like a checklist almost of the things to do, of reversing. I think the only thing he really added outside was his anti-immigrant agenda, which he, you know, was committed to with great fervor.
Well, you've called Trump's demand for a wall on our southern border short on reality and long on fantasies. I mean, what do you think should be done then for this immigration situation?
This, you know, the immigration situation we find ourselves in is a failure of Congress. And it's been one that this country has been dealing with and faced with for a long time. It's in the void of humane, safe policy that we get the Stephen Millers and Steve Bannons of the world to fill in the gaps. And Congress needs to act. The responsibility to enact comprehensive immigration reform lies with Congress.
What would you like to see happen?
Well, I think there needs to be a humane path to legal status for Dreamers and for a lot of other immigrants in particular statuses. There, obviously, nobody's saying that we shouldn't have border security. We need to have border security. But the elements that go into that, there really needs to be kind of a moral reimagining of our immigration policy, given who we are as a country. You know, Stephen Miller has as a target asylum. He wants to end asylum seeking and refugees coming to the border entirely. And we know that. He's been quite explicit about it. But that is not where I think most Americans are. I know that plays to the base, and it's going to get played a lot more in the upcoming presidential election. I mean, Trump has used this as an electoral strategy, and we will see it get worse.
It's going to obviously be incredibly heated, incredibly agitated election. Which of the candidates who've currently sort of declared or about to declare or you think might declare do you think will be the best?
I'm not falling for this bait.
Hang on.
Okay.
For civil rights.
Oh, for civil rights.
Yes.
You know, even then, I can't say right now. I am really excited by the field. I think, you know, some people are like, oh, my God, there's going to be 30 Democrats and what's going to happen onto the Republicans. I think it's important right now, given the moment we're in, that there are a number of candidates that are putting themselves in the ring. There's also several that are taking themselves out that we thought were going to be announcing. What I want is to make sure that every candidate, Republican or Democrat, is reckoning with what kind of country we want to be. We have had an effort to redefine who we are in a very narrow sense, some would say in a kind of white supremacist sense, over the last 2 years. And I think that the presidential election is – this one in particular – is a really important one for defining and redefining who we want to be as a country. And I want every one of the candidates to have to talk about voting rights, about criminal justice reform, policing, around women and the fact that women are, you know, some of the most – it's the most energized kind of constituency. And I want these issues to be front and center because, unfortunately, we know or I can anticipate that the president – is going to use the same anti-immigrant and anti-everything rhetoric that he used in 2016, and it will force a response. But I think this is an important moment to be aspirational and affirmative about the vision that people have.
So what do you think are the things we should all be the most alert for in the next year or two that, you know, you think may not be necessarily front burner to people's, you know, news gathering thoughts?
Yeah. But, you know, I think that I am deeply concerned about what will happen with immigrants and immigration. We know that this president has used immigrants as an electoral strategy. I fear that that will get ramped up. We saw it play itself out with this crazy, you know, border wall shutdown, which we are not out of the woods in this moment, and we'll see what happens there. There's other issues that are, you know, not talked about that much. I'm worried about the census. It's this kind of thing that happens every 10 years in this country. It is being deliberately weaponized for political purposes with the insertion of a citizenship status question in really inappropriate ways. And yet the census defines political apportionment in the House of Representatives. It will define redistricting for the next 10 years and how power gets divvied up. It will define how $800 billion of federal money gets allocated to every part of this country. There are huge consequences to a sabotage census. And we now know, because there's been litigation around the country about the citizenship question, that Steve Bannon and Kris Kobach really lobbied for the addition of this question for rather what we know are rather nefarious purposes, to kind of restructure the ways in which our democracy is carried out. So we are at the leadership conference.
And that's a hard one, because to make people think about it, it's not a sexy issue.
No, it isn't. And it's harder there because, you know, you can't tell the story in the same way. And yet it's foundational to our structural democracy. But there are other issues that I think we, you know, we're going to be paying attention to. There's a lot of good that's happening, too, in local communities and at state level around pushing for voting access, criminal justice reform. The good news is that while the dysfunction kind of continues in Washington, there are a lot of people in the states that are really leading the way, and we need to support those efforts. And people are energized in a way that they've never been before.
Well, you're not even 45. This is what's so staggering. Is an Attorney General Vinita Gupta in the future?
Oh,
what,
please.
What do you want for the next 10 years?
I have never lived my life honestly thinking about what my next move was. I have been a lifelong civil rights lawyer. I work on a broad range of issues, and that's what gets me going every day. I don't know what the next 10 years are going to hold. I know that I will always be working on these issues. I care deeply about the country. It's hard for me to ever sit on the sidelines. But there are so many different ways. I've been in government. I've been out of government. There are so many different ways to have an impact and to build power for the kind of country we want to be. And so my hope is I will continue to do this work as long as I can and as long as it feels meaningful. But it's also really exciting. You're saying I'm not yet 45. I'm feeling like, wow, there's like for the first time, I'm not the young person in the room. And seeing the young energy around, you know, the activists who've been fighting gun violence and arguing for common sense gun safety laws, and the young folks, the dreamers that are really kind of pushing the boundaries of our thinking, that's what's so exciting to me.
Well, Vanita Gupta, thank you so much for being the justice warrior that you are. And thank you for joining TBD.
Thank you, Tina.
You've been listening to TBD with me, Tina Brown, brought to you by Wondery. You can subscribe to TBD on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or keep up with us however you listen to podcasts. If you like what you heard today, please spread the word. Tweet about it, Instagram it, or post about it on your favorite fake Russian account on Facebook. TBD is produced by Tina Brown, Kathleen Russo, Julie Subrin, Karen Compton, Monica Hickey, and Justine Giannino. Original music composed by Forrest Gray. Come back next time for more smart people on TBD.